After marriage, she began a campaign to change him through the force of her will and her love. Which brings us to the third consequence of Melanie's realization of her childhood wishes and fantasies. Her belief in her own omnipotence. Young children normally believe themselves, their thoughts, and their wishes to be magically powerful, the cause of all significant events in their lives. Ordinarily, however, even though a little girl may passionately wish to be her father's partner for life, reality teaches her that she cannot. Like it or not, she eventually must accept the fact that his partner is her mother. This is a great lesson in her young life, that she cannot always bring about, through the power of her will, that which she wants most. Indeed, this lesson does much to dismantle her belief in her own omnipotence and helps her to come to terms with the limitations of her personal will. In the case of young Melanie, however, that most powerful wish came true. She did, in many ways, replace her mother. Apparently, through the magical powers of her wishes and her will, she won her father for herself. Then, with an undaunted belief in the power of her will to bring about what she desired, she was drawn to other difficult and emotionally charged situations, which she also tried to magically change. The challenges she later uncomplainingly faced, armed with only the weapon of her will, an irresponsible, immature, and unfaithful husband, the burden of raising three children virtually alone, severe money problems, and a demanding academic program coupled with a full-time job, all testified to this. Sean provided Melanie with a perfect foil for her efforts to change another person through the power of her will, just as he met the other needs fostered by her pseudo-adult role in childhood, in that he gave her ample opportunity to suffer and endure, and to avoid sexuality while exercising her predilection for nurturing. It should be very clear by now that Melanie was in no way a hapless victim of an unhappy marriage. Quite the opposite. She and Sean met every one of each other's most profound psychological needs. Theirs was a perfect fit. The fact that his mother's timely gifts of money conveniently short-circuited any drive toward growth or maturity in Sean was certainly a problem to this marriage, but not, as Melanie chose to see it, the problem. What was really wrong was the fact that here were two people whose unhealthy patterns of living and attitudes toward life, though by no means identical, meshed so well that they actually enabled each other to remain unhealthy. Imagine these two, Sean and Melanie, as dancers in a world in which everyone is a dancer and grows up learning his or her individual routines. Due to particular events and personalities, and most of all by learning the dances that were performed with them throughout their childhoods, Sean and Melanie each developed a unique repertoire of psychological steps, movements, and gestures. Then, one day they met and discovered that their dissimilar dances, when performed together, magically synchronized into an exquisite duet, a perfect pas de deux of action and reaction. Each movement made by one was responded to by the other, resulting in choreography that enabled their joined dances to flow, uninterrupted, round and round and round. Whenever he let go of a responsibility, she quickly picked it up. When she gathered to herself all the familiar burdens of raising their family, he pirouetted away, allowing her plenty of room to do her caretaking. When he searched the stage for other female companionship, she sighed with relief and danced faster to distract herself. While he danced away, exiting off stage, she performed a perfect waiting step, round and round and round. For Melanie, it was sometimes an exciting dance, often a lonely one. Occasionally, it was embarrassing or exhausting. But the last thing she wanted was to stop the dance she knew so well. The steps, the moves, all felt so right that she was sure the name of the dance was love. Chapter 5. Shall We Dance? How do women who love too much find the men with whom they can continue the unhealthy patterns of relating that they developed in childhood? How, for instance, does the woman whose father was never emotionally present find a man whose attention she continually strives for but cannot win? How does the woman from a violent home manage to team up with the man who batters her? How does the woman raised in an alcoholic home find a man who already has or will soon develop the disease of alcoholism? How does the woman whose mother always depended on her emotionally find a husband who needs her to take care of him? Out of all the possible partners they encounter, what are the cues that lead these women to the men with whom they can perform the dance they know so well from childhood? And how do they respond, or not respond, when they encounter a man whose behavior is healthier and less needy, or immature or abusive, than what they are accustomed to, whose dance does not fit so smoothly with theirs? It is an old cliché in the field of therapy that people often marry someone just like the mother or father with whom they struggled while growing up. This concept is not quite accurate. It is not so much that the mate we choose is just like mom or dad, but that with this partner, we are able to feel the same feelings and face the same challenges that we encountered growing up. We are able to replicate the atmosphere of childhood already so well known to us, and use the same maneuvers in which we are already so practiced. This is what, for most of us, constitutes love. We feel at home, comfortable, exquisitely right with the person with whom we can make all our familiar moves and feel all our familiar feelings. Even if the moves have never worked and the feelings are uncomfortable, they are what we know best. We feel that special sense of belonging with the man who allows us, as his partner, to dance the steps we already know. It is with him that we decide to try to make a relationship work. There is no more compelling chemistry than this feeling of mysterious familiarity when a woman and a man come together whose patterns of behavior fit like pieces of a jigsaw puzzle. If, added to this, the man offers the woman an opportunity to grapple with and try to prevail over childhood feelings of pain and helplessness, of being unloved and unwanted, then the attraction becomes for her virtually irresistible. In fact, the more pain from childhood, the more powerful the drive to reenact and master that pain in adulthood. Let's look at why this is true. If a young child has experienced a trauma of some kind, it will appear and reappear as a theme in his or her play activities, until there is some sense of having finally mastered the experience. A child who undergoes surgery, for example, may reenact the trip to the hospital using dolls or other toy figures, may make himself the doctor in one such drama, and the patient in another, until the fear attached to the event is sufficiently diminished. As women who love too much, we are doing much the same thing, reenacting and re-experiencing unhappy relationships in an attempt to make them manageable, to master them. It follows that there really are no coincidences in relationship, no accidents in marriage. When a woman believes that she inexplicably had to get married to a certain man, one she would never have deliberately chosen for her husband, for instance, it is imperative that she examine why she chose to be intimate with that particular man, why she ran the risk of pregnancy with him at all. Likewise, when a woman claims that she married on whim, or that she was too young to know what she was doing, or that she wasn't fully herself and could not make a responsible choice, these are also excuses that merit deeper examination. Actually, she did choose, albeit unconsciously, and often with a wealth of knowledge about her future partner, even at the outset. To deny this is to deny responsibility for our choices and our lives, and such denial precludes recovery. But how do we do it? What exactly is the mysterious process, the indefinable chemistry that is sparked between a woman who loves too much and the man to whom she's drawn? If the question is restated in other ways, what signals flash between a woman who needs to be needed and a man who is looking for someone to take responsibility for him, or between a woman who is extremely self-sacrificing and a man who is extremely selfish, or between a woman who defines herself as a victim and a man whose identity is based on power and aggression, or a woman who needs to control and a man who is inadequate. The process begins to lose some of its mystery. For there are definite signals, definite cues that are sent out and registered by each of the participants in the dance. Remember, with every woman who loves too much, two factors are operating. One, the lock and key fit to her familiar patterns with his. And two, the drive to recreate and overcome the painful patterns from the past. Let us take a look at the first hesitant steps of that duet, which informs each partner that here is someone with whom it is going to work, to fit, to feel right. The following stories illustrate clearly the almost subliminal exchange of information that takes place between a woman who loves too much and the man to whom she is attracted, an exchange that instantly sets the stage for the pattern of their relationship, their dance, from then on. Chloe, 23-year-old college student, daughter of a violent father. I grew up in a really crazy family. I know that now, but when I was young, I never thought about it except to hope that no one would ever find out about the way my father hit my mother. He hit all of us, and I guess he sort of convinced us kids that we deserved being beaten. But I knew Mom didn't. I always used to wish he'd hit me instead of her. I knew I could take it, but I wasn't so sure that she could. We all wanted her to leave him, but she wouldn't. She got so little love. I always wanted to give her enough love to make her strong so she could get out, but she never did. She died of cancer 5 years ago. I haven't been home or spoken to my father since the funeral. I feel that he killed her, really, not the cancer. My grandmother on my father's side left each of us kids a trust fund, and that's how I was able to go to college, which is where I met Roy. We were in an art class together for a whole semester and never spoke to each other. When the second semester began, several of us were together again in another class, and on the first day, we all got into this heavy discussion about relationships between men and women. Well, this guy started talking about American women being totally spoiled, wanting to have everything their own way and how they just used men. He was dripping with venom as he was saying all this, and I thought, oh, he's really been hurt, poor thing. I asked him, do you really think that's true? And I started trying to prove to him somehow that women weren't all like that, that I wasn't like that. Look at how I set myself up. Later on in our relationship, I would not be able to make any demands or take care of myself in any way, or I'd be proving him right in his misogyny. And all my concern that morning in class worked. He was hooked, too. He said, I'll be back. I wasn't going to stick with this class, but I want to talk to you some more. I remember that right then, there was this terrific rush because already I felt I was making a difference to him. In less than 2 months, we were living together. In 4 months, I was paying the rent and almost every other bill, plus buying the groceries. But I kept trying for 2 more years to prove to him how nice I was, how I wasn't going to hurt him the way he'd already been hurt. I got hurt quite a bit in the process. At first, just emotionally, then physically, too. No one could be as angry as he was at women and not want to push one of them around. Of course, I was sure that was my fault, too. It's a miracle I got out. I met a former girlfriend of his, and she asked me right out, does he ever hit you? I said, well, not really. I was protecting him, of course, and I didn't want to look like a total fool either. But I knew she knew because she'd been there, too. At first, I panicked. It was the same feeling I had as a kid, not wanting anyone to see behind the facade. Everything in me wanted to lie, to act like she had a lot of nerve asking such a question. But she looked at me with so much understanding that it didn't make sense to go on pretending. We talked a long time. She told me about a therapy group she was in where all the women were alike and that they were all drawn to unhealthy relationships, and they were working on learning not to do that to themselves. She gave me her phone number, and after I'd gone through 2 more months of hell, I called her. She got me to go with her to the group, and I think it probably saved my life. Those women were just like me. They had learned to put up with incredible amounts of pain, usually starting in childhood. Anyway, it took me a few more months to leave him, and even with the group's support, it was still very hard to do. I had this incredible need to prove to him that he was lovable. I thought that if I could just love him enough, he'd change. Thank God I got over that, or I'd be back there again. Chloe's attraction to Roy. When Chloe, the art student, met Roy, the misogynist, it was as though she was meeting the synthesis of her mother and her father. Roy was angry and hated women. To win his love was to win that of her father, who was also angry and destructive. To change him through her love was to change her mother and save her. She saw Roy as a victim of his sick feelings and wanted to love him into becoming well. She also, like every woman who loves too much, wanted to win in her struggle with him and with the important people he symbolized for her, her mother and father. That is what made letting go of this destructive and unfulfilling relationship so difficult. Mary Jane, married for 30 years to a workaholic. We met at a Christmas party. I was there with his younger brother, who was my age and really liked me. Anyway, there was Peter. He was smoking a pipe and wearing a tweed jacket with patches on the elbows, and he looked so Ivy League. I was terribly impressed. But there was also an air of melancholy about him, and really that was as attractive to me as his looks. I was sure he'd been deeply hurt at some time, and I wanted to get to know him, to know what had happened, and to understand. I was sure he was unattainable, but I thought if I could be especially compassionate, perhaps I could keep him talking to me. It was funny because we did talk rather a lot that first evening, but he never quite squared off with me face to face. He was always at an angle, slightly preoccupied with something else, and I kept trying to win his complete attention. What happened was that every word he spoke to me became vitally important, almost precious, because I was sure he had better things to do. It had been just like that with my father. When I was growing up, he was never there, literally. We were quite poor. He and my mother both worked in town and left us kids at home alone much of the time. Even on weekends, he did odd jobs. The only time I saw Dad was when he was home fixing something, the refrigerator or the radio or something. I remember it always felt like he had his back to me, but I didn't mind because it was just so wonderful to have him around. I used to hang around and ask him lots of questions to try and get him to pay attention to me. Well, here I was, doing the same thing with Peter, though of course I didn't see it that way then. I remember now how I kept trying to be in his direct line of vision and how he kept sort of puffing away at his pipe, looking off to the side or up at the ceiling or fiddling with keeping the pipe lit. I thought he was so very mature, with his furrowed brow and faraway look. I was drawn like a magnet. Mary Jane's attraction to Peter. Mary Jane's feelings about her father were not nearly as ambivalent as those of many women who love too much. She loved her father, admired him, and yearned for his company and attention. Peter, being older and preoccupied, instantly replicated for Mary Jane her elusive father, and winning his attention became all the more important because, like with her father, he was so difficult to capture. Men who willingly listened to her, who were more emotionally present and more affectionate, failed to arouse in Mary Jane the deep yearning to be loved she had felt with her father. Peter's preoccupation offered a familiar challenge to Mary Jane, another chance to win the love of a man who avoided her. Peggy, raised by a hypercritical grandmother and an emotionally unsupportive mother, Now, a divorced single parent with two daughters. I never knew my father. He and my mother separated before I was born, and my mother went to work to support us while her mother took care of us at home. Now that doesn't sound too bad, but it was. My grandmother was a terribly cruel woman. She didn't beat my sister and me as much as she hurt us with words every day. She would tell us how bad we were, how much trouble we caused her, how we were good for nothing. That was one of her favorite phrases. The irony was that all of her criticisms just made my sister and me try harder to be good, to be worthwhile. My mother never protected us from her either. Mother was too afraid Grandma would leave and that she wouldn't be able to go to work because there would be no one to take care of us. So she just looked the other way when Grandma abused us. I grew up feeling so alone, so unprotected and afraid and worthless, all the while trying to make up for being a burden. I remember I used to try to fix things that broke around the house, wanting to save us money and earn my keep somehow. I grew up and married at 18 because I was pregnant. I was miserable from the start. He criticized me all the time, subtly at first, then more savagely. Actually, I knew I wasn't in love with him, and married him anyway. I didn't think I had any other choice. It was a 15-year marriage because it took me that long to believe that being miserable was a good enough reason to get a divorce. I came out of that marriage desperate for someone to love me, but feeling that I was worthless and a failure and sure that I had nothing to offer a good, kind man. The night I met Baird, it was absolutely the first time I had ever gone out dancing without a date. My girlfriend and I had been shopping. She bought a whole outfit, pants, top, new shoes, and wanted to put them on and go out. So we went to the disco place we'd both heard of. Some businessmen from out of town were buying us drinks and dancing with us, and that was okay. Friendly, but not very exciting. Then I saw this fellow over next to the wall. He was very tall, very slim, dressed incredibly well, and very good-looking. But he also had an air of coldness about him. I remember telling myself, that is the most elegant, arrogant man I've ever seen. And then, I'll bet I could warm him up. Incidentally, I can still remember the moment when I met my first husband. We were in high school, and he was lounging against the wall when he should have been in class, and I said to myself then, he looks pretty wild. I'll bet I could settle him down. See? I was always trying to fix things. Anyway, I went up to Baird and asked him to dance. He was very surprised and, I guess, a little flattered. We danced a while, and then he said he and his friends were leaving to go to another place. Would I like to go? Though I was tempted, I said no. I was there to dance, and that was really all I wanted to do. I kept dancing with the businessmen, and after a while, he asked me to dance again. So we did. It was incredibly crowded in there. People were just packed in. A little later, my girlfriend and I were leaving, and he was sitting with some other people at a table in a corner. He beckoned me over, and I went. He said to me, "You have my phone number on your person." I didn't know what he was talking about. He reached over and pulled his card out of the pocket of the pullover I was wearing. It was one of those shirts with a pouch pocket in front, and he'd put his card in there when we were coming off the dance floor the second time. I was amazed. I hadn't even known he'd done that. And I was so thrilled to think that this handsome man had taken all that trouble. Anyway, I gave him my card, too. He called me a few days later, and we went to lunch. He gave me this terribly disapproving look when I drove up to meet him. My car was kind of old, and I immediately felt inadequate, and then relieved that he would have lunch with me anyway. He was very stiff and cold, and I took it on myself to put him at ease, as though it was my fault somehow. His parents were coming to town to visit him, and he didn't get along with them. He recited a long list of grievances against them, which didn't sound all that serious to me, but I tried to listen compassionately. I left that lunch thinking that here was someone with whom I had nothing in common. I had not had a pleasant time. I had felt uncomfortable and sort of off balance. When he called 2 days later and asked me out again, I somehow felt relieved, as though if he had had a good enough time to ask me out again, then everything was all right. We never did have a really good time together. Something was always wrong, and I kept trying to make it right. I felt very tense with him, and the only good times were when the tension lessened somewhat. That bit of relief from tension passed for happiness, but somehow I was still powerfully attracted to him. I know it sounds crazy, but I actually married this man without ever liking him. He broke off the relationship several times before we married, saying he just couldn't be himself with me. I cannot tell you how devastating that was. I would beg him to tell me what I needed to do to make him more comfortable. He'd just say, "You know what you need to do." But I didn't. I nearly went crazy trying to figure it out. Anyway, the marriage lasted only 2 months. He left for good after telling me how unhappy I made him, and I've never seen him again, except once in a while on the street. He always pretends he doesn't know me. I don't know how to convey how obsessed I was with him. Each time he left me, I felt more drawn to him, not less. And when he came back, he would say that he wanted what I had to offer him. There was no rush on earth like that for me. I would hold him in my arms, and he would cry and say what a fool he'd been. That kind of scene lasted only one night, and then things would start to disintegrate again, with me trying terribly hard to make him happy, so he wouldn't leave again. By the time he walked out of the marriage, I was hardly functioning. I was unable to work or to do much at all except sit and rock back and forth and cry. It felt like I was dying. I had to get help in order not to contact him again, because I wanted so badly to make it turn out right. But I knew I couldn't survive another ride on that merry-go-round. Peggy's attraction to Baird. Peggy knew nothing about being loved, and having grown up without a father, knew virtually nothing about men either, certainly not kind, loving men. But she knew a great deal from her childhood with her grandmother about being rejected and criticized by someone very unhealthy. She also knew how to try as hard as she could to win love from a mother who could not, for her own reasons, give love or even protection. Her first marriage happened because she allowed herself to be intimate with a young man whom she experienced as critical and condemning of her, and for whom she felt little affection. Sex with him was more a struggle to win his acceptance than an expression of her caring for him. A 15-year marriage to this man left her even more convinced of her inherent unworthiness. So strong was her need to replicate the hostile environment of her childhood and continue her struggle to win love from those who could not give it, that when she met a man who struck her as being cold, aloof, and indifferent, she was instantly attracted to him. Here was another opportunity to change an unloving person into someone who would finally love her. Once they became involved with each other, his infrequent hints that she was making some headway in teaching him to love her enabled her to keep trying, in spite of the devastation to her own life, her need to change him, and her mother and grandmother whom he represented, was that strong. Eleanor, 65, raised by an overly possessive, divorced mother. My mother couldn't get along with any man. She divorced twice in an era when nobody divorced even once. I had one sister, 10 years older than I, and my mother said to me more than once, "Your sister was your father's girl, so I decided to have one for me." That's exactly what I was to her, a possession and an extension of herself. She didn't believe we were separate people. I missed my father so much after they divorced. She wouldn't let him near me, and he didn't have the will to fight her. Nobody did. I always felt like a captive, and yet responsible for her happiness at the same time. It was very hard for me to leave her, even though I felt like I was suffocating. I went to business college in a distant town, where I stayed with relatives of ours. My mother was so angry she never spoke to them again. After school ended, I was working as a secretary in the police department of a large city. One day, this good-looking officer in uniform came in and asked me where the drinking fountain was. I pointed it out to him. Next, he asked me if there were any cups. I let him borrow my coffee cup. He needed to take a couple of aspirin. I can still see him throwing his head back to swallow those tablets. Then he said, "Whew, I really tied one on last night." Right then I said to myself, "Oh, how sad. He's drinking too much. Probably because he's lonely." He was just what I wanted. Someone to take care of. Someone who needed me. I thought, I sure would like to try and make him happy. We married 2 months later, and I spent the next 4 years trying. I used to cook these wonderful meals, hoping to lure him home, but he'd go drinking and wouldn't return until it was very late. Then we'd fight, and I'd cry. The next time he stayed out late, I'd blame myself for getting upset the last time, and tell myself no wonder he doesn't come home. It got worse and worse until finally I left him. All that was 37 years ago, and just this last year I realized he was an alcoholic. I'd always thought it was all my fault, that I just couldn't make him happy. Eleanor's attraction to her husband. If you've been taught that men are no good by a mother who hates men, and on the other hand, you loved your lost father and find men attractive, you're very likely to grow up fearing that the man you love will leave you. You might therefore try to find a man who needs your help and understanding so that you can have the upper hand in the relationship. This is what Eleanor did when she found herself drawn to the handsome policeman. Although this formula is supposed to protect you from getting hurt and getting left by assuring that your man is dependent upon you, the trouble with it is, you must begin with a man who has a problem. In other words, a man who is already on his way to fitting the men are no good category. Eleanor wanted to guarantee that her man would not leave her, as her father had, and as her mother said any man would. And his neediness seemed to provide that guarantee. But the nature of his problem rendered him more likely to leave, not less. Thus, the situation that was supposed to assure Eleanor that she would not be abandoned, instead, virtually guaranteed that she would. Every night that he did not come home proved her mother had been right about men. And finally she, like her mother, obtained a divorce from a no-good man. Arlene, 27, from a violent family in which she tried to protect her mother and siblings. We were in an acting company together, performing at a dinner theater. Ellis was 7 years younger than I and not very physically attractive to me. I wasn't particularly interested in him, but one day we did some shopping together and went to dinner afterward. As we talked, all I could hear was that his life was just so messy. There were all these things he wasn't taking care of, and when he talked about them, I got this terrific urge to get in there and set it all straight. He mentioned to me that first evening that he was bisexual. Though that didn't fit in with my value system, I turned it into a joke and said that I was too, that when someone got sexual with me, I said, "Bye." Actually, I was really afraid of men who came on too strong. My former husband had been abusive to me, and so had another boyfriend. Ellis seemed safe to me. I was as sure that he couldn't hurt me as I was that I could help him. Well, we got heavily involved not long after that. In fact, we lived together for several months before I called it quits, and the whole time I was tense and afraid. Here I thought I was doing him such a favor, and yet I was a wreck. My ego took a beating, too. His attraction to men was always much stronger than his attraction to me. In fact, the night I was hospitalized, deathly ill with viral pneumonia, he didn't visit me because he was involved with a man. 3 weeks after I got out of the hospital, I ended my relationship with him, but it took an enormous amount of support. My sister, my mother, and my therapist all helped me through it. I became terribly, terribly depressed. I really didn't want to let go. I still felt he needed me, and I was sure that with a little more effort on my part, we could make it together. When I was a kid, I had always felt that way too, that any minute I'd figure out how to fix it all. There were five of us kids. I was the oldest, and my mother leaned on me a lot. She had to keep our father happy, which was impossible. He's still the meanest man I know. They finally divorced about 10 years ago. I guess they thought they were doing us a favor, waiting until we had left home. But it was miserable growing up in that family. My father hit us all, even my mother. But he was the worst with my sister in terms of violence, and with my brother in terms of verbal abuse. He crippled each of us in one way or another. All I ever felt was that there must be something I could do to make everything better. But I never quite figured out what that would be. I tried talking to my mother, but she was so passive. Then I'd stand up to my dad, but not very much because that was too dangerous. I used to sort of coach my sister and brother on how not to get in dad's way, not to talk back. We would even come home from school and go through the house just to figure out what might upset him, in order to fix it before he got home in the evening. We were all so scared and unhappy so much of the time. Arlene's attraction to Ellis. Because she saw herself as stronger, more mature, and more practical than Ellis, Arlene hoped to have the upper hand in her relationship with him, and thereby avoid being hurt. This was an important factor in his appeal for her, because she had a history of being physically and emotionally abused, starting in childhood. Her fear and rage toward her father made Ellis, in contrast, appear to be the perfect answer to her problems with men, because it seemed unlikely that he would ever respond so strongly toward her as to become violent. Unfortunately, in the few months they were together, she experienced as much hurt and heartache as she had with the heterosexual men she had known. The challenge of trying to literally and figuratively straighten out the life of a man who was basically gay was commensurate with the level of struggle Arlene knew so well from childhood. The emotional pain inherent in this relationship was familiar, too, always waiting for the other shoe to drop, to be hurt or shocked or offended by someone who was supposedly on her side, who supposedly cared for her. Arlene's conviction that she could coerce Ellis into becoming what she needed him to be made it difficult for her to finally let go. Susanna, 26, divorced from two alcoholics, daughter of an emotionally dependent mother. I was in San Francisco attending a 3-day training seminar to prepare me to pass my state boards for my license as a social worker. At the afternoon break of the second day, I spotted this very handsome man, and when he passed by, I flashed him my sunniest smile. Then I went off to sit outside and relax. He came up to me and asked me if I was going up to the cafeteria. I said, "Sure, I could go." And when we got there, he said a little hesitantly, "Can I buy you something?" I had the feeling he couldn't really afford it, so I said, "Oh, no, that's okay." So I bought myself some juice, and we went back and talked for the rest of the break. We told each other where we were from and where we worked, and he said, "I'd like to have dinner with you tonight." We made arrangements to meet at Fisherman's Wharf, and when I met him there that evening, he looked troubled. He said he was trying to decide whether to be romantic or practical, because he had only enough money with him to either take me on a cruise of the bay or to dinner. Of course, I jumped right in and said, "Let's go on the cruise and I'll take you to dinner." So we did, and I felt strong and clever because I'd made it possible for him to do both things he wanted to do. It was very beautiful out in the bay. The sun was setting and we talked the whole time. He told me how afraid he was to be close to someone, that he was in a relationship now that had gone on for years, but he knew it wasn't right for him. He just stayed because he was so fond of the woman's 6-year-old son and couldn't bear to think of the boy growing up without a male figure in his life. He also hinted pretty broadly that he was having sexual difficulties with this woman because he wasn't all that attracted to her. Well, all my wheels were turning. I was thinking, this is a wonderful man who just hasn't met the right woman yet. Obviously, he's tremendously compassionate and honest. It didn't matter that he was 37 years old and had probably had plenty of chances to develop a good relationship. That maybe, just maybe, something was wrong with him. Here he'd given me a virtual shopping list of his flaws, impotence, fear of intimacy, and financial problems, and it didn't take much intelligence to figure out that he was pretty passive, too, from the way he operated. But I was too enchanted with the idea that I could be the one to make a difference in his life, to be warned off by what he was saying. We went to dinner, and I paid, of course. He protested, saying how much it bothered him, and I just twinkled at him that he could come visit me and take me out to dinner to pay me back. He thought that was a great idea, wanted to know all about where I lived, where he could stay if he came down, what the job opportunities were in my town. He had been a school teacher 15 years before, and after many job changes, each, he admitted, for less money and less prestige, was now working in an outpatient counseling clinic for alcoholics. Well, that was perfect. I'd been involved with alcoholics before and had been torn up in the process, but here was someone safe, someone who couldn't possibly be alcoholic because he counseled them, right? He did mention that our waitress, an older woman with a gravelly voice, reminded him of his mother, who was an alcoholic. And I knew how frequently children of alcoholics develop the disease of alcoholism themselves. But he never drank the whole evening, just kept ordering Perrier. I was practically purring, thinking, this is the man for me. Never mind all those job changes and the fact that his career picture in general had been going downhill. That had to be due simply to bad luck. He seemed to have a lot of bad luck, and that made him more appealing. I felt sorry for him. He spent quite a lot of time telling me how attracted he was to me, how comfortable it felt to be with me, how well matched we were. I was feeling exactly the same way. We parted ways that night with him acting the perfect gentleman and my kissing him goodnight very warmly. I felt so safe. Here was a man who wasn't going to push at me to be sexual, who just wanted to be with me because he enjoyed my company. I didn't take this as a sign that perhaps he really did have sexual problems and was therefore trying to avoid the whole thing. I guess I was sure that, given the chance, I could solve any little difficulties he had. The seminar ended the next day, and afterward we talked about when he could visit me. He suggested he come the week before his exams and stay at my apartment, but he wanted to just study while he was there. I had a few days of vacation coming up and thought it would be great to take it during that time so we could sightsee together. No, his exams were too important. Pretty soon, I was disregarding everything I would want to do, as I tried to make it all perfect for him. I was also more and more afraid he wouldn't come down, even though having someone staying in my apartment studying while I went to work every day didn't sound like a lot of fun. But I had this need to make it right, and already felt guilty if he wasn't happy. And there was this terrific challenge to keep him interested. He had started off so attracted to me that now, if he cooled off, it would feel like I had blown it. So I was standing on my head trying to keep him involved. Well, we parted ways with things still unsettled, even after I had come up with plan after plan, trying to solve all the problems involved in his coming down. I felt depressed after we said goodbye, and I didn't know why, just kind of bad that I hadn't been able to fix it all and make him happy. He called me the next afternoon, which made me feel wonderful. I felt redeemed. The following night he called me at 10:30 and began to ask me what he should do about his present girlfriend. I didn't have the answers on that one and told him so. My discomfort was really increasing now. I felt set up somehow, and for once didn't follow an old pattern of mine to jump in and try to fix it. He began to yell at me over the phone and then hung up on me. I was stunned. I began to think, maybe this is my fault. I wasn't helpful enough. And I had this terrific urge to call him back and apologize for making him so angry. But remember, I had been involved with several alcoholics, and because of this, I was going regularly to Al-Anon meetings. Somehow, that program kept me from calling him and accepting all the blame. Well, in a few minutes, he called back and apologized for hanging up. Then he asked me all the same questions, which I still couldn't answer. He yelled some more and hung up on me again. This time I realized he had been drinking, but I still had the same urge to call him back and try to make everything all right. If I had taken responsibility for him on the phone that night, we might be together right now. And I shudder to think what that would be like. A few days later, I received this very civil note saying he wasn't ready for another relationship at this time. No mention of the yelling or hanging up on me. That was the end. A year earlier, it would have been just the beginning. He was the kind of man I had always found irresistible, handsome, charming, a little needy, not quite living up to his potential. In Al-Anon, when someone mentions how she was attracted not to what a man was, but to his potential, we all have a great laugh together because we've all done it. Been drawn to someone because we were sure he needed our help and encouragement to maximize his gifts. I knew all about trying to help, to please, to do all the work and take all the responsibility for a relationship. I'd done it as a child with my mother, and then with each of my husbands. My mother and I had never gotten along well. She had lots of men in and out of her life, and when there was someone new, she didn't want to be bothered with having to take care of me, so I was trotted off to boarding school. But whenever one of them left her, then she wanted me around to listen while she cried and complained. When we were together, it was my job to comfort and soothe her, but I could never do it well enough to take away her pain, and she'd get angry at me for not really caring. Then another man would come along, and she'd forget all about me again. Of course, I grew up making a career of trying to help people. That was the only time I felt important or worthwhile as a child, and I had developed a need to become better and better at it. So it was a great victory for me to finally overcome the urge to pursue a man who had nothing to offer me, other than the opportunity to help him. Susanna's attraction to the man in San Francisco. A career in social work was nearly as inevitable for Susanna as her attraction to men who appeared to need her comforting and encouragement. The first hint she had about this new man was that money was a problem for him. When she took his cue and paid for her own juice, they each exchanged vital information. He let her know that he was a little needy, and she responded by paying her own way and protecting his feelings. This theme, that he was lacking and she had enough for both of them, was repeated when they met for their date and she paid for their dinner. Problems with money, problems with sex, problems with intimacy, the very cues that should have been warnings for Susanna, given her history of involvement with needy, dependent men, were instead the signals that attracted her because they stirred her nurturing, caretaking behavior. It was very difficult to ignore what was for her a powerful hook. A man who was not quite okay as he was, but who, it seemed, with her help and attention, could become something special. Susanna was not able at first to ask, "What's in this for me?" But because she was in the process of recovery, she was finally able to assess what was happening in a realistic light. For the first time, she paid attention to what she was getting out of the relationship, rather than totally focusing on how she could help this man in need. It is obvious that each of the women we have talked about found a man who presented her with the kind of challenge she had already known, and who was therefore someone with whom she could feel comfortable and fully herself. But it is important to understand that none of these women recognized what was attracting her. If that understanding had been there, there would also have been a more conscious choice about whether to enter such a challenging situation. Many times, we believe we are attracted by qualities that appear to be the opposite of those our parents possessed. Arlene, for instance, finding herself drawn to a bisexual man much younger than herself, of slight build, and anything but physically aggressive toward her, consciously felt she would be safe with a man unlikely to repeat her father's pattern of violence. But the less conscious struggle to change him into what he was not, to prevail in a situation that from the beginning was obviously not going to meet her needs for love and security, that was the inviting element in developing a relationship with him. And that was what made it so difficult for her to let go of him, and the challenge he represented. Even more convoluted, but just as common, is what happened between Chloe, the art student, and her violent misogynist. Every clue about who he was and how he felt was present in their first conversation. But her need to take on the challenge he represented was so great that instead of seeing him as dangerously angry and aggressive, she perceived him as a helpless victim, needing understanding. I would venture to guess that not every woman meeting this man would see him thus. Most would give him and his attitudes wide berth. But Chloe distorted what she saw. So strong was her drive to engage with this man and all he represented. Once begun, why is it so difficult to stop these relationships, to let go of the partner who is dragging you through all the painful steps of this destructive dance? A rule of thumb is, the more difficult it is to end a relationship that is bad for you, the more elements of the childhood struggle it contains. When you are loving too much, it is because you are trying to overcome the old fears, anger, frustration, and pain from childhood. And to quit is to surrender a precious opportunity for finding relief and rectifying the ways you have been wronged. While these are the unconscious psychological underpinnings that make explicable your drive to be with him in spite of the pain, they do little justice to the intensity of your conscious experience. It would be difficult to overstate the sheer emotional charge that this kind of relationship, once begun, carries for the woman involved. When she tries to cut herself off from relating to the man she loves too much, she feels as though thousands of volts of painful energy are rushing through her nerves and spilling out their severed ends. The old emptiness surges and swirls around her, pulling her down into the place where her childhood terror of being alone still lives, and she is sure she will drown in the pain. This kind of charge, the sparks, the chemistry, the drive to be with that other person and to make it work, are not present to the same degree in healthier, more satisfying relationships, because they do not embody all the possibilities for settling old accounts and for prevailing over what was once overwhelming. It is this thrilling possibility of righting old wrongs, winning lost love, and gaining withheld approval that for women who love too much is the unconscious chemistry behind falling in love. This is also why when men come into our lives who are interested in our well-being and in our happiness and fulfillment, and who present the genuine possibility of a healthy relationship, we usually are not interested. And make no mistake, these kinds of men do come into our lives. Each of my clients who has loved too much has been able to recall at least one, often several men, whom she has described wistfully as really nice, so kind, actually cared about me. Then usually comes the ironic smile and the question, now why didn't I stick with him? Often she is able, in the next breath, to answer her own query. Somehow I could never get that excited about him. I guess he was too nice, huh? A better answer would be that his actions and our reactions, his moves and our countermoves, didn't mesh into a perfect duet. Although being in his company might be pleasant, soothing, interesting, and affirming, it is difficult for us to regard this kind of relationship as important and worth developing on a more serious level. Instead, such a man has usually been either quickly dropped or ignored, or at best relegated to the just-a-friend category, because he failed to arouse in us the heart-pounding and stomach-nodding we have come to call love. Sometimes these men remain in the friend category for many years, meeting with us now and then for a drink and drying our tears as we report the latest betrayal, breakup, or humiliation in our current relationship. This sympathetic, understanding kind of man simply cannot offer us the drama, the pain, or the tension that feels so exhilarating and right. This is because, for us, what should feel bad has come to feel good, and what should feel good has come to feel foreign, suspect, and uncomfortable. We have learned, by long and close association, to prefer the pain. A more healthy, loving man cannot play an important part in our life until we learn to let go of the need to relive the old struggle again and again. A woman with a healthier background has responses and thus relationships that are very different, because struggling and suffering are not so familiar, not so much a part of her history, and therefore not so comfortable. If being with a man causes her to become uncomfortable, hurt, worried, disappointed, angry, jealous, or otherwise emotionally upset, she will experience that as disagreeable and aversive, something to be avoided rather than pursued. On the other hand, she will pursue a relationship that offers her caring, comfort, and companionship because it feels good to her. It would be safe to say that the attraction between two people who have the capability of creating a rewarding relationship based on the exchange of healthy responses, while perhaps strong and exciting, is never as compelling as the attraction between a woman who loves too much and the man with whom she can dance. Chapter 6. Men Who Choose Women Who Love Too Much. How does it work for the man involved? What is his experience of the chemistry that occurs in the first few moments of meeting a woman who loves too much? And what happens to his feelings as the relationship continues, especially if he begins to change and becomes either healthier or sicker? Some of the men whose interviews follow have gained an unusual degree of self-knowledge, as well as a considerable insight into the patterns of their relationships with the women who have been their partners. Several of these men who are recovering from addictions have the benefit of years of therapeutic involvement in Alcoholics Anonymous, or Narcotics Anonymous, and are thus able to identify the appeal the codependent woman held for them as they sank into or were already caught in the web of addiction. Others who have not had problems with addiction have nevertheless had involvement with more traditional kinds of therapy, which helped them understand themselves and their relationships better. Though the details differ from story to story, always present is the appeal of the strong woman who somehow promises to make up for what each man is lacking in himself or his life. Tom, 48, sober for 12 years. Father died of alcoholism, as did an older brother.
I remember the night I met Elaine. It was at a dance at the country club. We were both in our early 20s and both with dates. My drinking was already a problem. I'd had one arrest for drunken driving at 20 and 2 years later a serious car accident, which happened because I'd had too much to drink. But of course, I didn't think alcohol was doing me any harm at all. I was just a young man on the way up who knew how to have a good time. Elaine was with an acquaintance of mine who introduced us. She was very attractive, and I was happy when we did that changing partners for one dance kind of thing. Naturally, I'd been drinking that night, so I felt a little bold. Since I wanted to impress her while we were dancing, I tried some steps that were pretty fancy. I was trying so hard to be suave that I literally ran into another couple and knocked the wind right out of the woman. I was really embarrassed and couldn't say much except to sort of mumble that I was sorry, but Elaine never missed a beat. She took the woman by the arm, apologized to her and her partner, and walked them to their seats. She was so sweet that the husband was probably glad the whole thing happened. Then she came back, very concerned about me, too. Another woman might have been angry and never spoken to me again. Well, I wasn't about to let her get away after that. Her father and I always got along great until he died. Of course, he was an alcoholic too. And my mother loved Elaine. She kept telling her that I needed someone like her to look after me. For a long time, Elaine kept covering up for me the way she had that first night. When she finally got help for herself and stopped making it easy for me to continue drinking, I told her she didn't love me anymore and ran off with my 22-year-old secretary. After that, I went downhill fast. It was 6 months later that I attended my first AA meeting, and I've been sober ever since. Elaine and I got back together after I'd been sober a year. It was real hard, but there was still a great deal of love there. We're not the same people who married 20 years ago, but we both like ourselves and each other better than we did then, and we work on being honest with each other every day.
Tom's attraction to Elaine. What happened between Tom and Elaine is typical of what happens between an alcoholic and a codependent on first meeting. He gets in trouble, and she, rather than be